From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Some North Carolina lawmakers want to give victims of childhood sexual abuse more time to take their abusers to court. You'll learn why. One of the most contentious debates in this year's General Assembly has involved fish. You'll hear lawmakers debate the pros and cons of a bill dubbed Let Them Spawn. A North Carolina congressman, Patrick McHenry, draws attention to the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS, movement. It targets Israel. And you'll learn how a recent U.S. Supreme Court decision could affect North Carolina's future congressional elections, as well as those across the country. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
What does it mean to guarantee a sound basic education to school-age kids in North Carolina? Well, that's the question at the heart of a decades-old court case that's now back in the news. Dr. Terry Stoops is Vice President for Research. He's also the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. He joins us now with the very latest on the case known as Leandro. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
It seems like the nut of this whole case, which dates back to the 1990s, actually, is whether or not kids are receiving a sound basic education. And that's actually a phrase from the North Carolina Constitution. So how do we measure that?
Well, it's usually measured by looking at test scores. And when you start looking at student performance measures, you find that there are some places, some schools that are doing better than others. And typically, the idea is that the reason why some of these schools are doing better than others is due to money. And that's really the question that we're going to have to face, is that will an increase in funding raise student achievement? And that has always been the question with Leandro since the case was filed in 94 and decided by the Supreme Court in 97. What role should money play in being able to provide what the Constitution provides, which is a sound basic education?
We had some school districts who sued, essentially saying they did not believe that the constitutional requirement was being fulfilled in their areas. But then you said the North Carolina Supreme Court ruled. So tell us about what the Supreme Court said, and then why is this case still lingering on?
Well, what the Supreme Court did was to decide that there were plenty of students in North Carolina that weren't receiving sound basic education. And so to be able to monitor the state's compliance with the constitutional requirement, the case was remanded to a Wake County Superior Court. And for years, Judge Howard Manning was overseeing the implementation of Leandro. He wrote some very influential memoranda about the implementation of Leandro. And of course, he would have hearings and ask the state about what it was doing to try to meet that constitutional requirement. Judge Manning retired in 2015, and Judge David Lee was appointed in his place to oversee this case. In 2017, the plaintiff and the defendant came together and said that they wanted an independent consulting firm to look at the issue of what the state should do. And that's where we are today. The group WestEd was hired to look at the case, look at North Carolina's education system, and determine what the next step should be.
Terry, it just seems that this is a case that is inherently could go on forever. It's already gone on since the 90s. So have we even determined what we think the actual measuring stick will be? Is it a dollar amount? And once we meet that point, we're going to say, yes, the constitutional requirement has been met. Or is it student test scores? Or how do we measure?
And that's the key. In other states, and by the way, this was a multi-state strategy by some folks to increase education funding, was to file these types of lawsuits. So it didn't just happen in North Carolina. It happened in other states as well. In other states have had very different experiences. In some, there were massive increases in education funding, which didn't always translate to increases in student achievement, because the relationship between those two is rather inconsistent, and the research really shows that it takes more than just money to increase student achievement. In some other states, it kind of lands flat. So the increase in funding that's recommended is maybe put into place, but some of the other recommendations aren't followed. So what happens in North Carolina will be really interesting to see going forward. The real question at the heart of this, and this is where we're at in 2019 with the Leandro case, is will the judge order the General Assembly to spend more money? That's really the concern, because in the past, Judge Manning has not been willing to tell the legislature to spend a dollar amount. And so Judge David Lee may decide that that has to happen. And of course, that would be a crisis with the separation of powers, the judiciary telling the legislative what to do. So that's really what we're all waiting for, is to see if he goes ahead and does that.
Not only constitutional crisis potentially, but just an issue of effectiveness. As you said, there is not a direct connection between spending and student achievement. So it seems like if that order were to come and the order were to prevail, well, my goodness, how would we know that kids were learning?
That's absolutely right. And when you look across North Carolina, you find that some school districts are much more productive than others. In other words, some school districts are really able to spend their money in a very effective way. Union County is always the example of a low-spending, high-achievement county as far as student performance in North Carolina. But we have lots of counties that receive far above the state average per pupil expenditure that don't produce good results. And so even if you look just anecdotally in North Carolina, you see that there is no consistent relationship between spending and student achievement. But because we don't really have a good sense of how to raise student achievement, the idea is that, well, since we don't really know, let's just put more money into it and we'll figure it out as we go along.
You mentioned the West End report, the independent consultant. We also know that Governor Cooper has a commission that's meeting on this. Are those two things connected, the West End report and the governor's group?
Yeah, absolutely. The governor, of course, wants to find a way to increase education funding and believes that this Leandro case is one way to do it. And so he put together a commission, and this has occurred in other states where the governors have put together a commission to make recommendations on what should be included in the action plan for the judge to order the state to do. So we know that money is going to be part of it, but what other types of reforms are going to be included? This commission is going to recommend a whole range of different things, including some charter schools, some school nutrition policy. There's a very broad look at pre-kindergarten one is a rather prominent one in this commission. A whole range of policies with hopes that the judge will implement these policies through a court order along with the increase in funding.
So is the governor's group then trying to make recommendations that play off of the West End report and dovetail with that, or are they coming up with their own separate list of things they think should happen? How will that work?
Well, they came up with their own separate list, and they released a preliminary report of some of the list of things they believe should be included. But the commission hasn't seen the West End report. So until they know what's in it and whether their recommendations merge with what West End says, we don't quite know what they are going to recommend.
It seems odd that they would make recommendations knowing that a consultant is preparing a report. Why wouldn't they wait?
Well, that's a reasonable question, but they don't want to wait. I think they want to have this in place in preparation for 2020. I think this is all about the timing for the next gubernatorial election and the possibility of a change in the leadership of the General Assembly. So we see some strategy, some political strategy being played out. This isn't just about policy, and I think that's the one thing that people should know about the Leandro case, is that there is policy involved, but this is really around the politics and finding a way to ensure that the General Assembly spends more money on schools.
Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some North Carolina lawmakers want to make it easier for victims of child sexual abuse to go to court. Republican Representative Dennis Rydell explains.
This is a bill about helping to prevent child sexual abuse. This is not a happy topic that any of us want to discuss, but it's a necessary one. The AMA calls child sexual abuse a silent epidemic in our land. The bill seeks to resolve that epidemic by doing several things. Currently, there are 42 million survivors of sexual abuse in our country. If you take a conservative number that half of those 42 million are victims of childhood sexual abuse, you come up with 21 million victims in our land, in our nation. We've all been to the Vietnam Memorial. There's over 58,000 names on that memorial. To account for the 21 million victims of childhood sexual abuse would require over 350 Vietnam memorial walls and 58,000 names times 350. That's the extent of this. It is an epidemic. One in four women will be sexually abused before their 18th birthday. One in six men will be sexually abused before their 18th birthday. Those four ladies you saw in the cafeteria enjoying a lunch together, likelihood of one being a victim is 100%. Last Saturday, those men you saw playing softball, the likelihood that one in six of them is a victim, 100%. This is an epidemic. It's a silent epidemic. Everyone here in this room, everyone hearing my voice, knows at least one, two, or maybe three victims of childhood sexual abuse. Now, if you say, no, I really don't know anybody like that, it's simply because the people you do know who are victims have chosen not to disclose it. And that's what makes this crime so insidious.
Rydell's bill would allow adults to go to court to address abuse from their childhood days. Why?
The victims of childhood sexual abuse sometimes take years or decades before they have the emotional strength to face down their abuser. The impact of a five-minute despicable and vile act with a child has lifetime consequences for the child and virtually none for the abuser. Less than 10% of predators spend any time in jail. The list of emotional problems that survivors go through are legion. The greatest is shame, and that's another reason why it's a silent epidemic. Who wants to talk about being violated as a child? Who wants to bring that subject up? So most victims bury it. You know, the typical human response to a traumatic event is repression. And that's what most of the victims of childhood sexual abuse end up doing, is repressing it, not talking about it. That doesn't solve the problem. We know today from brain science that trauma inflicted on a child, and child sexual abuse is the greatest of those, that trauma inflicted or experienced by a child can damage the brain. The child's brain is developing through their juvenile years up into adulthood, up into the mid-20s. The brain is still growing and still making connections. And we know today from MRI studies and research that a victim of child sexual abuse, the trauma stops the development of certain parts of the brain.
That's State Representative Dennis Rydell. He's explaining a bill to help more victims of childhood sexual abuse take their abusers to court. He's talking about long-term negative impacts on the abuse victim's brain.
This can be undone through therapy, and they can get back to a normal life, but there is damage done, and that explains what happens with most of the victims of childhood sexual abuse. They end up with many antisocial pathologies. They have a higher incidence of drug abuse, a higher incidence of being re-victimized, a higher incidence of suicide, a higher incidence of health issues, a higher incidence of anger, of isolation, of feelings of hopelessness, betrayal, ambivalence. This all plays out in their life, and they end up becoming, oftentimes, customers, clients of our social services network, our juvenile justice system, and other healthcare networks. The average cost for a victim over their lifespan of services needed, therapy, so forth, is over $210,000. That's the average cost per victim. Who's paying that? Oftentimes it is the victim. Or it's going to be the taxpayer and the community.
So what would Rydell's bill do?
What this bill does, by extending the statute of limitations for a civil suit for victims of child sexual abuse, it allows us to shift the cost to the perpetrator and away from either the victim or the rest of us. 75% of women who seek treatment in various programs were victims of childhood sexual abuse. The cost annually in our country is over $150 billion. Currently, our law reads as follows. If you file a suit for criminal child sexual abuse, there is no statute of limitations. You can file that suit at age 85. You can file that suit at age 18. However, in the area of civil suits, to recover damages for the damage done to that young soul, to the damage done to that wounded heart, you only have between the age of 18 and 21 currently. Now, there is an exception possibly for a 10-year additional period to be added, depending on your age and the realization of when you were abused. But think about that. Most victims age out at 21. They cannot recover any costs. They are prohibited by law from doing so. They've been damaged, but who do they go to for justice? What this bill does is extend that age from 21 to 38. Understand, friends, that's low. The average age of disclosure for a victim of childhood sexual abuse is 52. I'm dealing with the realities of what I can get done. My bill originally had 45 years as the age. I brought it down to 38 to try to get the support we need to get it passed. We need to do something rather than nothing. It is time. It is past time for North Carolina to get serious about preventing child abuse, for North Carolina to get serious about helping those who are victims, and for North Carolina to stop being a safe haven for predators. If you are a predator, all you have to do typically is keep your victim shut up until the age of 21, and you have nothing to worry about. Is that the kind of state we want to be? A place that is a harbor, a safe harbor for child predators? I think not.
Critics fear the bill could open the door to frivolous lawsuits. Representative John Torbett asked Rydell about that topic.
Would you mind touching base, if you know, about what's occurred in other states that have also extended their time period to a similar extension as ours?
Several states have a longer period than 38. Indeed, seven states, Alaska, Connecticut, Delaware, Florida, Illinois, Maine, Minnesota, and the territory of Guam, have no statute of limitations at all on civil proceedings. Now, those seven states I just listed, can anyone tell me where the wheels have come off their justice system because they have been inundated with false accusations? The answer is no. It has not happened in other states where this has been done, where the statute of limitations has either been eliminated altogether for civil suits, or it's been extended. Most recently, New Jersey established a statute of limitations for civil law, for civil suits, at the age of 55. This was done in the last several months. The trend in our land, friends, is recognizing the brain science that's out there, the long-term debilitating effects that it has on a child to be abused like this, and the ability to finally come forward only as an adult.
You've been listening to Debate About a Bill to Raise the Statute of Limitations for Civil Suits Involving Childhood Sexual Abuse. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During a recent U.S. House debate on retirement security, one North Carolina congressman tackled a different topic. 10th District Republican Patrick McHenry asked colleagues to support an amendment. It was against the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS, movement.
The BDS movement is an effort to weaponize the world's economy against one simple state, the great state of Israel and the Jewish people. They're trying to weaponize our economy, our dollars, against our only ally in the Middle East that's a democracy. This is an effort for us today, to say that we will stand against this movement. This movement is about anti-Zionism. Anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. Let us speak with one clear voice today that we, as the American people, will not stand for this economic warfare. We will stand with our ally, and we will stand with the Jewish people in the Israel state. Why weaponize our economy against Israel? to destroy Israel, to choke off economic growth, to choke off economic opportunity, and thereby weaken the state of Israel so they get rolled into the sea. That is unacceptable. That is the notion of the BDS movement. It may be polite in certain companies to say you boycott, you divest, you sanction the state of Israel. It is not polite to say that you're anti-Semitic. But what the BDS movement says is that you're anti-Semitic. What you say by supporting the BDS movement is that you are okay with discriminating against people because of their faith. This body has a long history of working together in a bipartisan fashion. I've worked for 3 years to hammer out a bipartisan approach to stopping the BDS movement. That got rolled into the bill that was passed in January in the Senate. 77 senators joined together and sent a bill over here to the House. We've waited 4 months with no vote on that bill. And it's not because we don't have bipartisan support to stop the BDS movement. We do. We do. In this chamber, we've stood together in a bipartisan forum to stand against hate and to stand against anti-Semitism. But the leadership over there don't want us to have a vote on that bill. So today, we're saying, let's have the vote. Let's stand up for the state of Israel. Let's stand against hate. Let's stand up against this anti-Zionism and the anti-Semitism that underlines it. Let's stand up for our Jewish friends and allies. And let's speak with one voice that the BDS movement is anti-Semitism.
That's U.S. Representative Patrick McHenry, Republican from North Carolina's 10th District. On a largely party-line vote, the Democratic-led U.S. House rejected McHenry's amendment. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. One of the most hotly contested issues during this year's session of the North Carolina General Assembly involved fish. Specifically, a proposal dubbed Let Them Spawn. It was designed to place new restrictions on the types of fish fishermen can catch in North Carolina waters. Representative Larry Yarbrough says the bill follows years of failed reforms.
Unfortunately, North Carolina's reform has not worked. North Carolina seems to be the only southern state that has done this badly. It's been almost impossible to do anything about it since then. And I think you can see why. You've heard confusing scientific claims that seem to be in direct conflict. You've heard moving stories about the good, hardworking people that are in danger of losing their lives, struggling to make a living with these declining fish populations. It's a very difficult issue, and it has proven to be too much for a volunteer board of commissioners, as well as a department of bureaucrats that just want to keep their jobs and work through this minefield.
Yarbrough cited evidence.
Scientific reports indicate that too many of these fish are being harvested as juveniles, and there's not enough reproduction going on. When the Wildlife Resources Commission has a population that is overfished, they set the size limit where the fish are old enough to reproduce. That's what Let Them Spawn does. It gives the Marine Fisheries Department a goal of setting size limits that would allow 75% of the fish a chance to spawn at least once. It's a simple idea. It's not going to solve everything, but it's a start.
The idea faced a mixed response. Representative Larry Pittman doesn't believe new regulation is necessary.
I believe all this bill is about is for the Carolina Coastal Coastal Conservation Association, CCEA, the elites, to keep all the fish to themselves. That's what this is about. And the reduction in numbers of fishermen, commercial fishermen, it's not because there are fewer fish. It's because they've been regulated to death. And many of them just couldn't continue under the strict regulations that have been put on them. So this is just about killing off the commercial fishing industry some more.
Representative Jay Adams supported the change. He cited the legislature's need to protect a public resource.
Folks, I have looked at the data over the last 35 years. And you can, the scientists can debate it, but I'm telling you, if you look at it, it's clear. This resource has been terribly depleted. And now we talk about, we are looking right now at the complete collapse of some of the fisheries. We've got to act.
Representative Pricey Harrison opposed the bill.
This proposal is not based on scientific need. It undermines the Fisheries Reform Act and the General Assembly's intent in enacting the Fisheries Reform Act. That process that was created, it's the science comes from the Division of Marine Fisheries, stakeholder committees of advisors, includes all the experts in this area and recreational and commercial fishermen, environmentalists, university professors, all participate in a very deliberative process in adopting fishery management plans for each of the important fisheries to North Carolina. And we have a current Division of Marine Fisheries head whom we heard from yesterday in rules who is committed to this process and committed to making tough decisions and committed to scientific reform. And I think we need to defer to that.
Representative Bobby Hoenig opposes the measure for different reasons.
I urge you not to allow special interests to regulate our resources and keep hardworking taxpaying citizens from working. They did not ask for subsidies or special treatment, just the right to make a living for their families. They say that our resource has been overfished. Then don't shut it down. Find a way to enforce the current rules and implement the current rules. Don't punish everyone. This bill is just another attempt to overregulate the fishing industry. I know that you have a friend of a brother whose cousin has a friend who knows a guy that has a boat that you went out on 5 years ago and caught fish. What I need you to keep in mind, and please keep this in mind, this bill will keep the guy who catches the bait that you caught that fish with from working. This bill will literally destroy hardworking, salt-of-the-earth North Carolinians, the ability to put food on their table. This bill has far-reaching negative consequences. We here in the legislature have been cutting and cutting the commercial fishermen for years. Eventually, the industry will die out, and that will be on our heads.
Representative Keith Kidwell shared the thoughts of his fishermen clients.
I've prepared literally hundreds of tax returns for fishermen in Beaufort and Hyde County. I know these people personally. I've sat down and had long discussions with them on the things that they have to deal with, the regulations that they deal with as fishermen. The commonality I find, I've never had a single fisherman to tell me I'm quitting fishing because I can't catch fish. They quit because they're overregulated. That's their words, not mine. They've all told me the exact same thing. There's not a lack of fish. There's an abundance of regulations running our fishermen out of business in North Carolina. Please note that the people who oppose this bill, by and large, are from the coastal counties. We represent the coastal people who are dealing with these fish. And I assure you, the money you're looking at is huge if we put these commercial fishermen out of business. In the last 20 years, we have lost hundreds of jobs, not just fishermen, people. We're not just talking about the 6, 8, 10 guys that go out on the boat or the individual that goes out and does it himself. We're talking about the processing houses. We're talking about boat builders that we had in eastern North Carolina that are no longer there because there's no more fishing business. We're talking about people who repair the boats that are no longer implied. We're talking about the net makers and the people who repair the nets the ones who sell the bait, all of those businesses are gone out of eastern North Carolina. This bill is not a fish saver. It is a job killer.
But Representative Billy Richardson offered a different view.
The stocks of croaker catch in 97 were 10 million tons. They're now 1 million. In 97, spot were 2 million tons. They're now 413,000. Weak fish, 3.5 million tons. Now it's 85,000. Folks, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and over again and expecting a different result. We have said for 50 years now, let's let the marine fisheries work. Let's let the scientists work. We are entrusted by the people of the state of North Carolina to act responsibly. These are not my facts, y'all. We can choose to stick our hands in the sand. Does anyone in this room truly believe, in view of this evidence, that we are not facing a serious problem here? If you do, then I can't convince you. But the facts are overwhelming. We must fix this problem. This bill is not the fix-all, but it's a start. It's a message. It's a signal.
Lawmakers split nearly evenly on whether to institute new fishing regulations. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. It is the court ruling North Carolina had been waiting for, and now it is in. The United States Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision in Rucho versus Common Cause, has upheld North Carolina's disputed congressional maps. It is a victory for the Republicans in the General Assembly who drew these maps. My co-host Mitch Kokai joins me now to discuss the ruling. Mitch has been following this case very, very closely. Mitch, interesting. I don't have the opportunity to interview you on the show like this, but glad you can join me for this segment since you are an expert here on this. We have Chief Justice John Roberts of the Supreme Court who wrote this opinion. What did he say?
Basically, he said that partisan gerrymandering, which is the type of gerrymandering that was at issue in this case, is something the federal courts cannot address. This has been the type of argument that some justices have accepted for a number of years. There has been debate on the Supreme Court about this issue of partisan gerrymandering and whether federal courts should get involved at all. There's always been a block on the Supreme Court that has said, no, this is a political issue. Judges cannot find any kind of legal standard that would help us decide how much partisanship is too much when you're drawing election maps. There's also been another block that has said, no, this is something that is terrible in our system, and we need to find a way to come up with a way to determine when some level of partisanship is too much. But there's been debate for decades about what that standard is. Basically, the decision that came down from Chief Justice Roberts was, look, we're never going to find a standard. There are five justices on this court who agree with that. So partisan gerrymandering cases should no longer go through the federal courts at all.
Now, it obviously was not a unanimous decision. It was a 5-4. Writing for the dissent was Justice Elena Kagan, and she had some incredibly pointed and harsh words about this decision. Tell us what her view was.
Yeah, she expressed deep sadness that her conservative colleagues, the five members who voted in the majority, voted in the way they did. And basically, she says that gerrymandering is anti-democratic in the most profound sense. That's a direct quote from her, because it deprives people of their ability to fully choose who represents them. And she said, of all times to abandon the court's duty to declare the law, this was not the one. Basically, Elena Kagan was saying, the five justices in the majority, you punted on this. We could have come up with a way to come up with a standard that would say that some level of partisanship in drawing election maps is too much.
Now, this decision and these maps were really about political advantage. And we should make clear that we know that the use of race in drawing districts is unconstitutional. And that is very clear. And that is not the question at all that was afoot here in this case. We're talking about partisan political advantage. Mitch, explain to us, or just remind us how this works every 10 years. Who is it that gets to draw the maps and why?
Yeah, every 10 years after we get new census data in this state, in North Carolina, the General Assembly gets to draw maps for not only Congress, but also its own seats, the State House and State Senate. That process takes place after the census, in the first year after the census. For decades now, every time that has happened, the party that's in the minority in the General Assembly has gone to court and said that there's been some problem with the maps. And usually the process has involved claims of racial gerrymandering. And as you said, racial gerrymandering has been determined to be unconstitutional. But there have also been arguments about too much partisanship, and that's something that's been floating in the courts for a number of years. There have been different tests put forward as ways to determine whether a map is too partisan or okay constitutionally. The Supreme Court has never been able to agree on a standard, but now this decision, because of the five justices in the majority joining together, have said, we're never going to be able to find a standard. Partisan gerrymandering is bad, but federal courts cannot get involved because there's no way for us to have a standard that will work.
If the federal courts then cannot get involved here in North Carolina, then does that mean the status quo is that the General Assembly, whichever party is in control after each 10-year census, they draw the maps?
That is exactly right. But one of the things that was interesting in Chief Justice Roberts' opinion is that he said, look, we all know partisan gerrymandering is bad, but there are other ways to address this. Congress could take steps. Congress could pass a law that would force the states to change the way they draw election maps. State legislatures could take steps, and we know that there are bills in North Carolina that would change that. He also suggested in some cases that state courts could. He mentioned specifically the Florida Supreme Court, which threw out a congressional election map for Florida because it violated something within that state's constitution that calls specifically for fair districts. So he said, look, the federal courts have no role in this, but that doesn't mean other actors can't get involved.
Moving forward then, how do we try to address this question of, for example, Bob Phillips of Common Cause has said that what he is looking for and other advocates are looking for are competitive districts, quote, fair districts. Does that mean we have to go to an independent commission, take this out of the hands of the General Assembly? What are the options?
Well, there are options involving either setting up an independent commission or having some legislative staffers set up temporarily to do this process. The bills moving through the North Carolina General Assembly, and I should say sitting in the North Carolina General Assembly, they really haven't moved, would address this issue in a couple of different ways. But a caveat to what Bob Phillips said, one of the interesting pieces in Chief Justice Roberts' ruling was he talked about all of these various arguments for fair election maps and said, you know, it's hard to determine what exactly is fair. If we got 13 competitive congressional districts in our map, because we have 13 congressional seats, if we had 13 competitive districts, it could be possible in one election for all of them to go to one party, because one party has a particular advantage during an election cycle. They win all of the competitive races, so they have all 13 seats. He said, is that what you mean by fair? Or do you mean by fair that there should be some sort of proportionality, that if Democrats get 51% of the vote statewide, that they should get somewhere in the neighborhood of 51% of the seats? He said, if that's what you want, then what you really want is for the General Assembly to draw districts so that each party is assured to win pretty much all of the districts each time around. And he said, and that's exactly opposite of what's being talked about in this case. He said, the fairness issue, you have to decide what's fair first. And then after you decide what's fair, then you would have to decide how to go about doing that. And that, he said, is going to be very difficult.
As you mentioned, there are a number of bills that are not moving, but sitting in the General Assembly, at least as you and I are talking. So what comes next? Any thoughts on the likelihood of a next move by someone or somebody?
Well, I think there's going to be an additional push to try to get some action on those bills. But the other thing we haven't yet mentioned yet is that although the Supreme Court has ruled, there's also a state court case dealing with the legislative districts that's going to be taking place a little bit after we're talking now. It's in the month of July. That case is going to go to court challenging the maps under the state constitution. And that's a whole different kettle of fish. The plaintiffs in that case say that there are provisions in our state constitution that ban partisan gerrymandering. So it'll be very interesting to see if the state courts, including the state Supreme Court, decide to throw out the maps.
Mitch, you have been paying very close attention to all of these types of map cases. Do you anticipate we can ever reach a point where these districts, whether it's congressional or General Assembly seats, where they don't go to court, where someone doesn't say this isn't fair?
At this point, I can't see it. About the only option perhaps would be if they have some sort of independent process that everyone buys into. At this point, we aren't there yet.
Fascinating. Mitch Kokai, thanks so much.
Thanks, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. On behalf of Mitch and me, I'm Donna Martinez. Thanks for listening. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.